Don't worry about all these technical things until you get to the point where somebody's actually demanding that. Make things sound good and stay simple, and then figure it out as you get further on down the road.
That's John March. I'm Steve Cleveland, and this is Sync Club. Today we're joined by special guest host David Bondalevich. All right, so David Bondalevich, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. Welcome to the club.
Thanks.
Hey, before we introduce our guest, why don't you give us a little background on yourself? Give us the highlights.
I lived and worked in Los Angeles for 22 years in the film and television industries. I worked in all areas of post-production. About a third of my credits were as music editor, who the music editor is often working for the music supervisor. About a third of my credits were dialogue editing, which is a fairly technical job, but it's a nice change of pace. Because you get to do it alone in a room without anyone looking over your shoulder.
Okay.
And about a third of the credits are as re-recording mixer, who would be the people doing the final mix for the film. That one, honestly, I think is by far the most challenging of the jobs, and it's why I usually preferred editing to mixing. To me, it's much more easy and much more fun.
Okay.
I worked on all sorts of projects. I was president of the Motion Picture Sound Editors for 2 years. Mm. I have been secretary of the Cinema Audio Society for a whopping 14 years, and I'll be leaving at the end of this term. Mm-hmm. And I teach full-time at the University of Colorado Denver in the Recording Arts Program, where I teach post-production audio and, of course, on film music.
Well, I want to just thank you for coming on today and guest hosting with me. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I'd just like to kind of make a comment that today we're kind of getting away from the business side of Music Sync to discuss some of the technical elements and what maybe an indie artist can set themselves up with in the studio so that they have the best possible deliverables when they get that opportunity to get a placement. So with that in mind, let's introduce our guest, John March. Welcome to the club.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good.
Good.
Was that succinct enough? I just want to make sure.
I think that worked. Yeah, thanks. So, John, thanks again. We do appreciate you being here. And David, I'm going to let you drive the discussion. I do have a few questions, and I'll try to fit them in as the conversation allows.
Okay,
so the guest is yours, David. Have fun.
Thanks. John, you want to talk a little bit about how you got into recording music and the types of artists you've dealt with?
Sure. I've been doing this since I was very young. I mean, my first experiences in studios was my uncle had an amateur recording studio, and I grew up in New York City, so I was gigging fairly early as a musician. I was in a Jimi Hendrix cover band playing at Max's Kansas City and CBGB's back in the early 70s. I went to a lot of different music schools, and I had a real passion for playing and touring and recording. And in my early 20s, I was given the opportunity, I was asked to replace Jeff Beck on a tour with the Steel Wheels tour. I was asked to audition. And I didn't make it all the way through. I think it was Joe Satriani who ended up going. And at that time...
not a bad person to lose a gig to.
No,
exactly.
I was 22 years old and getting a call at 2 a.m. from Mick Jagger saying, would you like to replace Jeff Beck? I actually hung up on him several times
because he didn't believe him.
No, I didn't. But the at that time, my dad had been a freelance filmmaker. He said, look at what you want to do, and then be able to support yourself doing things that are in that same field, but not necessarily always playing. And so I looked around, and I ended up becoming the first freelance synclavier programmer. It was a kind of a roundabout way, but I went into New England Digital and I convinced them to sell me a set of manuals, and I memorized them. And then 6 weeks later, I was the synclavier programmer at a record plant in New York.
That's how Alan Silvestri got into film scoring. He bought a synclavier, which at that time I think cost like $500,000.
The cheap ones were about $1 million at that point, because you have to remember at that point one meg of RAM was $1,000. Wow. 1 meg of hard disk space was $1,000.
So you did not own your own then?
I ended up owning 4 of them over time.
Wow.
My start was sort of a accidental. But I ended up being able to study with a lot of really great musicians, engineers. In fact, a mutual friend of ours, David Bruce Nazarian, who was probably the most talented engineer and technical person and creative that I've ever known, was the guy who took me under his wing when I was very young and trained me.
And I know Bruce through the motion picture sound editors when we were on the board together. And unfortunately, Bruce passed away 2 years ago.
Yeah.
A very interesting guy.
Yeah. Smartest guy I've ever known. Perfect pitch. Eidetic memory. Taught himself how to speak Portuguese in 3 weeks.
Loved music and all kinds of music. Loved playing it. He was one of the first people to go into DVD authoring and mastering.
He was a Renaissance man. Total Renaissance man. He was the most creative and technical person. In fact, well, up until the time he passed, he was still the guy I would call when I was having a problem on a project. He would be the guy I would call. So, and that was my sort of early youth. I spent 4 or 5 years working for Bruce as an apprentice and then making money on the side. And then I moved into having my own studio and my own gear. And I think I was mostly in music. I was working for Michael Jackson and I was working for a lot of different artists in New York. I worked with Bruce on Anita Baker and I kind of slowly migrated into post because livelihood would allow me to, make more regular money while I was pursuing music projects on the side.
So were you living in Manhattan or were you living in LA?
I was in Manhattan up until about 90 or 91. And then I moved to Los Angeles to work with Bruce in a studio he built called Magnolia Studios. And I had a room there with a synclavier. There were, I think, 16 synclaviers in one building. Bruce had, I think, 8. And I had 2, and Eddie Jobson had 1, and I can't remember all the machines that were in the building. It was a synclavier heaven at that time.
Were any of those clients, like Michael Jackson, people who were working specifically for songs for film, or it was all just music recording?
I have to think because I have a non-disclosure that's still in effect, so let me just think how I can say this.
Any artists that you worked with, were any of them working with songs that were commissioned for a film, or were they mostly just music?
One project I did with Sting was commissioned for a Disney film. I don't know if it ever made it to the film. A lot of the projects that I worked on for films were usually music library houses. I worked with Billy Whiteacre and Big Planet Music and a lot of artists who were interested in developing libraries and catalogs specifically for music houses that were developing that kind of content.
That would be a whole subject of its own. I don't know if you want to talk about that at all, but I've dealt with music libraries as a music editor, but I've never really dealt with them as someone submitting music for it.
Yeah, it can depend on your relationship. You know, usually the composers, it depends on how you meet the music library. And I tried doing it. It wasn't really my fit. I don't like writing on demand like that, where it's very specific frameworks of content. It has to be, 2.5 minutes long, and it has to be editable down into specific formats, and has to have a beginning, middle, and end that can be structured where they're complete pieces. And the segments can all be broken down into 10, 15 second, 30 second, 60 second blocks that can be manipulated. It's a very challenging way of writing, I think.
Yes, and you basically just explained what people need to do if they want their music included in films and television.
Woo-hoo!
And that's prepare as many versions as you possibly can. And particularly, like you said, 60, 30, 15 commercial placement will actually, in many cases, make more money than any other kind of placement.
Yeah, I agree.
And if you don't have a musical statement that works in those intervals of 15, 30 in a minute, you're probably not going to get used because it requires more work for the picture editor to edit the sound to make it match the new picture.
Yeah, and lyrics are also a component of that, whether they're lyrics or not.
Yes. So, of course, there should always be a non-lyric version. Some people call that minus vocal or minus dialogue. But I would argue that that's usually not usable because you're getting rid of usually the melody. Or if it's a rap song, you're getting rid of the rap and just leaving a drum loop. So my reaction is to tell people that they should record an instrumental version in addition. So after you've done mixing the first one, you've got everything in place, just mute the vocal track and call in a sax player or a guitar soloist or someone that you want to be able to play a musical instrument instead of just a lyrical version. Otherwise, you're really eliminating a lot of possible placement opportunities.
Well, unless you know Shonda Rhimes. If you're friends with Shonda Rhimes, then you're going to place more because she likes the lyrical content balancing against the dynamic. And so does actually, I think, Aaron Sorkin and people like that. Snuffy Walden's a good friend of mine, and Snuffy wrote for Aaron for a lot of shows. And, a lot of his stuff was very emotionally driven instrumental music, but Shonda Rhimes actually wanted there to be lyric content so that she could write dialogue around the gaps in the lyric.
Interesting. That, of course, means you'd have to choose the music before you write the script.
It's interesting. I don't actually know the process for that. I mean, I would imagine that there's a, it's an editorial pacing decision where you've got, depending on how things are going within the scene, they can probably pace stuff around how the music lays out when they get to it. But I actually don't know what they do.
I know Carol Urban, who is the mixer for most of Shonda's shows now. So I can talk to her. I can find out who the music editor was.
Yeah, it's very well done. I mean, it's extremely it carries the story and the emotional arc. And I mean, there's technical sides and there's creative sides, and then placement. You know, the placement thing is like it's a crapshoot no matter what area of business we're in. You know, getting something placed or being called to do that is usually a relationship issue between either the composer and the songwriter, or the composer or the director and the producer, or the audio post super and the person being asked to create music for the show.
Back when I was working as a music editor and living in Los Angeles, this was before MP3s were a big thing. I would go home every day and open up my mailbox, and there'd be five or six CDs from various people who wanted me to place their music.
Yep.
And I'd say, unless I recognized the name, I never even opened the package, which I'm sure will piss off a lot of composers from that era. But realistically, you can't expect every music editor and music supervisor to listen to every piece of music that gets sent to them. So I usually work through referrals, or I work with libraries that I know are affordable for the shows that I'm working on.
Yeah, and again, it also depends on what you're trying to get to. And it's at different stages. There are different deliverable requirements for different stages. I mean, if you're demoing for a client, or you're demoing for a producer or a director, that's not the same as delivering to the stage. It's not the same elements that are going to be needed to deliver to the stage. And generally, you know, when I got called to actually do this interview, I was like, well, you know, my experience is I have a relationship with the mixers on the stage, or the producer or the director, and I'm given a deliverable spec, and I'm either creating the content or I'm working with a musician to create the content, another musician, and based on that deliverable spec, whatever the mixer needs for the stage that day is what I'm going to deliver.
And in my experience as a re-recording mixer, I would want as many splits as humanly possible. Mm-hmm. Some people call those stems, but technically stems are what you create in the final mix, so I try to avoid that word for confusion with the re-recording mixers. But as many stems as you can go wide, great. The biggest drawback to that is, first off, if they want to do it in 5.1, then they're using up an awful lot of voices.
Yep.
However, there's no real reason for most music to be done in 5.1 if you're giving people a lot of splits. That gives the re-recording mixer the opportunity to choose which channels they want which instruments coming out of.
Exactly.
So for instance, when I mix music for film, I almost always leave the center channel completely empty, because that's where dialogue comes from, and it's only going to muddy up the dialogue channel. So a lot of times I see 5.1 mixes come in that are mostly center channel because, you know, they're mixing like a radio mixer and they think that everything should come out the middle.
Yeah, I've seen that.
And same with the subwoofer. Other than kick drum and bass, don't put anything in the subwoofer. There's nothing else that really makes sound down there that you would ever want. And remembering your psychoacoustics, everything under 100 hertz chews up more of your brain power. So if you put a lot of low-frequency noise into a mix, you're getting in the way of the dialogue, even though it's not in the same frequency range. Subwoofer I would always want on its own so that I could delete it or bring it down if necessary.
Well, if you're doing a Jerry Bruckheimer film, then that's another issue.
Yes,
again,
of course.
Again, I think it's always in context. I worked on a film for Ted Turner for, I guess, 9 months called The Gettysburg. And I did all the design for the guns and explosions. And we recut that film, I don't even know how many times.
It was insane. I think I was working at Signet while they were doing that.
Oh, you were at Signet then? Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Bruce and I were on that gig, and it was hard. It was really hard because each characteristic element, you know, the Doppler effect of the musket balls, or the Doppler effect of the cannonballs, or the explosions where they were in terms of proximity or distance, and actually the directionality. My remembrance is that Mr. Turner wanted the gunshots from the north always coming from the left, and the gunshots and explosions from the south coming from the right. And that may have changed towards the end, but there was this whole sort of undercurrent political thing that he wanted. You know, that the north was the left and the
right.
I don't know. It was that particular kind of thing. But the mix was very challenging. And in the end run, to be honest, you know, music carried the day. Music and dialogue carried the day.
Yes, and that was Randy Edelman's score. I've worked with Randy a number of times, but not on that film. They did a quasi-sequel to it called The Hunley, which was about the the multiple-person submarine that was used in the Civil War. Mm. They really loved his broad lyrical approach to music, which is Randy's real talent. He knows how to write a melody.
Yeah, I like the score. I mean, he buried all of our work, but it was great. It was a good score.
Yes.
It was good. I mean, you know, the thing about STEMs, I mean, if we go step back a second, you know, when I talk to students, because they're always talking about STEMs and different things about the technical, I always try and describe mixing as, you know, the essential end result is a river, and that the elements that come into the river are tributaries, and then there are streams and little, you know, estuaries and little things that come into it. But when you're looking at it from the broad point of view, the final mix is the river, and then the tracks coming into it, and the STEMs are like, you know, rivers that are flowing into the ocean, which is the main mix, right? And
right.
You're trying to get to that thing. And when you can picture it that way, you can say, well, you know, there are global stems, right? There's always a dialogue stem. There's, you know, generally a nat sound. There's an effects stem. There's a music stem. And, you know, these sort of globalized things, because at the end, the mixes would become too complicated if you were trying to move 120 faders,
right,
you know, at the same time. And, you know, when you start grouping things, then people talk about, well, how do you break down a music mix? Well, what are the key elements of the music mix that the mixer is going to need control over that are, you know, everything should be in perspective. It's a mix. But then what if he needs less kick or more kick, or it's for television or it's for film? Those elements being subdivided is what gives the mixer control at the end of the day. That's really all I think of when I think of stems, or whatever people are calling stems or tracks.
Right. So, of course, most of the stuff I've done has been score music and not songs as a music editor. But in terms of score, typically people will want it, again, spread out as much as possible, where if there's vocals, that should always be on its own track. And by the way, the reverbs have to go on those tracks too.
Yep.
So sometimes people like to use one reverb on everything. And when they solo or mute the vocal track, the reverb isn't going with that. So unfortunately, for each split that you do, you have to have your own reverb so that you can keep those on the same splits or stems.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
But vocals, any ethnic instrument, any solo instrument, if there's a guitar or sax, any instrument that sounds weird. And that's because at some point during the mix, someone's going to say, what's that weird thing? Is that out of tune? Because they're hearing an instrument they've never heard before. Any type of melody that's playing under dialogue should probably be on its own stem if possible. So, you know, with an orchestral session, obviously that isn't possible. But I've done mixes where I had a two-channel mix and there was a soprano sax solo going under a woman's monologue, which is exactly in the same register as her. So we had to go back and deconstruct the mix and remix it with the sax much lower, and much reverb added to it so it sits behind the screen.
Sure.
And that's another suggestion is, if you listen to movies in a theater, you'll notice they put a ton of reverb on it. And there are several reasons for that. One is that it spreads out the field into 5.1. But also it places it behind the screen, whereas the dialogue is right up in front in your face.
Mm-hmm.
The putting it behind the screen gives more clarity to the stuff that's in the foreground. So that's another suggestion for people when they're making stems.
Very good.
And this is why you all should be studying with Dave.
And John. Steve, did you have any other specific questions?
Well, you know what? You guys are doing a great job of kind of just going right down my list. So, you know, I think one of the questions that I did have on stems was, or the source tracks, is should they be mastered? And if so,
well, let's talk about mastering for a second. Like it can depend on whether what the deliverable is, right? So
right.
If I'm delivering to you a stereo music track and it's coming from my record, more than likely I'm going to deliver you a master track. But there's a couple of important considerations to think about. Now, David, I'm going to talk in modern terms, okay? Not like when we were coming up, but in modern terms, people are recording these days in very high sampling rates and bit depths. You know, you'll see it's not uncommon now to see, like, you know, sample rates of like 190, 232, which I think is insane. But, you know, you'll see these things because there's math correlative. And it goes into this thing, which I'm not going to go into, called Nyquist theorem, but it has to do with the relationship of the number of samples and the bit depth to the frequency response. So the higher the sampling rate, the greater the number of frequencies you get. And the bigger the bit depth, the higher the larger the sort of dynamic range from silence to ultra loud is. And most film and video right now, audio delivers at 48 kilohertz sampling rate and 24 bit. Most. Mm-hmm. I mean, there can be some exceptions. I haven't encountered it yet, but I'm sure there are exceptions, or there will be. But most commercial devices don't play that. You know, it still gets compressed or resolved down when you're watching on your laptop and you're streaming Netflix. And then most audio for CDs is at 44/1/16. That's mm-hmm. that's still the deliverable standard, even though physical CDs are phasing out and they're just kind of going to be gone in the fairly near future. So when you talk about mastering for film, the function of mastering has to do with when you have disparate or differentiated music tracks across a CD, no matter how good a mixer you are and how carefully you're monitoring the ballistics of the metering, there's going to be discrepancies in amplitude, discrepancies in overall sound pressure level, discrepancies in overall EQ and timbre. And the whole idea of mastering originally is that when you had a record, a disc, you wanted the volume track to track to be even, and you wanted the overall color of the album to be fairly consistent so that people weren't kind of getting up and adjusting their amps and EQs and whatever they had off their turntable. Mastering and digital mastering now is make everything as loud as possible.
Yeah.
And try and balance to a degree EQ and color. So if you talk about having a mastered audio file for a film, if you're recording at a higher sampling rate, and there's an argument for that, I would argue against it. But if you're recording at a higher sampling rate and then you're going to downsample or you're going to master, there's no reason not to master at 48/24 for film. And that just gives you a more compressed, slightly more even and, you know, EQ color. If you're not going to hear track to track, just deliver the final mix. That's my opinion, Dave. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. And Steve, you'll probably want to cut out everything I'm about to say. mastering is two different things in the film world and the music world.
Yes.
In the film world, no self-respecting mixer would ever hand their mix over to someone else to remix it, basically.
Correct.
I always print mastered all my own films and TV shows, and every mixer I know does that. Why would you want someone else taking that beautiful, precious egg that you've worked on for weeks or months and then let them just screw it up? So it's a whole different mindset. And the idea of mastering in music, first of all, it's a black art. If you talk to any mastering engineer, they'll never tell you what they do, and they'll hide everything they do from you. And they wind up just basically crushing the dynamic range. Now, as a mixer for a film, dynamic range is everything in film. You can't keep an audience interested unless you use dynamic range. This is one of the problems with television, by the way, is that they have very compressed dynamic range because they have to match the levels of commercials. In a film,
that's changed a bit, but yes, in general, that's true. I mean, the compression at the broadcast stage, there is a matching of volume, but there was a whole thing for a long time where commercials were like, what, 6 dB louder or something like that. And then, but yes, in general, that's true that they're crushing the hell out of it for TV.
And for music, in most music that I listen to, but for mixing a film, I want to be able to make everything as wide as possible. If I need it crushed to make it sound like it's coming through a AM radio, I can do that. Mm-hmm. I can fix that for you. Whereas if you give it to me already crushed, I can't make it sound good if they want to bring it up in the foreground as a music montage or a transition. So I would say don't master your tracks at all before turning them in, which is pretty much what John said. Turn in the mix, or at the very least stems from the mix.
By the way, don't erase anything David said, but I have a lot of friends who are mastering engineers, so I just want to caveat by saying I have tremendous respect. And also the field that I work in for records in the last 5 years is I've been working with a lot of jazz artists and blues artists where the dynamic range is critical. Like, I just mixed a record for Mike Stern and Eddie Gomez. Mike Stern was with Miles Davis, and Eddie Gomez played with, I don't know, everybody, Bill Evans, Miles Davis, Chick Corea. And if I turned in, you know, a super crushed record, they would fire me. I mean, the whole record has to breathe like it's an organic, like you're in a room listening to these guys play. And those are the kind of projects I work on. I'm not interested in the super crushed stuff.
Yeah, even big bands, and especially classical music, the style of mixing in those is to be kind of like you're in the room with the musicians or in the hall, if it's a concert hall style.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And not the overly heavily produced where everything is as loud as it can be because that's what people think they like.
Yeah, I mean, Dave, I worked a gig for 2 years. I was the senior mixer for Fox Family Channel's on-air promos. And I ran an 8-man crew, and we did, I think, something like 10,000 spots a year, you know, where we were just, you know, a machine. People come in, voiceover, edit music, edit sound effects, edit design, and you do cut down 60, 30, 15, 10. And, you know, that, and you were delivering a lot of those a day. In that particular scenario, just whatever the music is going to get buried and crushed anyway.
Right.
You know, so you're not going to hear that. It's just there as sort of a filler bed for like some sort of energetic, you know, component. It's not any emotional component. In film, what David is talking about, which I respect tremendously, is that breath. And I always tried to mix with that sense of breath. It doesn't really go over in television at all.
No.
You know, you can't get away with that, because they really just want to hear dialogue and then whatever they can bring in to make it sound big. Different film producers are going to require different kinds of breath. You know,
yes.
Clint Eastwood is like, I think, one of the best sort of dynamic range guys, because you have these really delicate and then sort of large scale sound changes and shifts. But there's been a bunch of films lately where the mixing is getting a lot more subtle and much more interesting.
Well, a movie like The Quiet Place, because the script called for it. But with Clint Eastwood, of course, he's a musician, and he also is a old style director where he rarely does more than 3 or 4 takes on anything. So he really just likes that natural sound of whatever comes out.
Yeah.
In the movie Garden of Good and Evil, he did. He asked, who was it? A woman artist to record. I think it was Skylark for the opening. And when he got to the dub stage, he heard the mixer soloing all the stems, and he said, "Let's just use the vocals," which. Mm. Really sets a different tone for the beginning of the film than if it had just been a pop version or a jazz version of Skylark. Suddenly it became a much more intimate place. And that part of that has to do with dynamic range. He was willing to let the beginning be quiet.
Yeah. And we're also skipping an area, which I don't know, which is the new thing that's developed in the last 10 years of sound design, where sound design and music placement kind of bleed over each other. And sound design is not natural, you know, not sound effects. It's not Foley replication. It's not any kind of, you know, natural sound, but it's actually designed. Like American Gods, the show that came out recently, is a brilliant example of that. Really beautiful, amazing sound design and music textures moving and developing the arc and mixed incredibly well. In fact, one of the best sounding TV shows I've heard in quite a while.
Now, from a re-recording point of view, I would be a little afraid of that, because if you tell your sound editors to do this and you tell your music designers to do this, you end up with two things that sound so much like each other, they just don't sound good together.
So, yes.
I do think it's really important that if you are writing music for a film, you interact with the sound designer, which is really hard because the schedules are crunched. But on a movie like The Matrix, Dane Davis and Don Davis worked for a year. That movie obviously had a very large budget and a long post-production schedule. But they worked for a year together to figure out where it was going to be big and boomy in the sound effects and where it was going to be big and boomy in the music, so that they never really stepped on each other. And that kind of interface hardly ever happens. In fact, many times the re-recording mixer, the music editor, the composer, some of these people don't even meet until they are either on the dub stage or sometimes out in the audience when they're watching the premiere. I would much rather have everyone from post-production working together at the same time.
Yeah, and then there's the new model, which is none of that's happening at all anymore.
Right.
I mean, the reality is, if kids are listening to this, and I don't mean like children, but I'm saying because of my age, I can say younger people who are trying to figure out how to do this stuff. The reality is, you know, anybody can make a film now. The technology is available to them, and anybody can make a song because the technology is readily available. Doesn't mean it's a good film. Doesn't mean it's a good song.
Right.
But you know, those are readily available. And if you're talking to somebody or someone who's listening to this right now is getting overwhelmed with me and David talking about all the fancy schmancy stuff, which is just as stressful as the non-fancy schmancy stuff, by the way, if you care.
Yeah.
If you're making a song, make it a good song if you can. And, you know, try and mix it with a sense of breath and dynamics and play and interplay. Don't just crush the thing down. And then if you're worried about what you need to do, because everything's in Pro Tools or Cubase or Logic at this point, don't worry. You can mix your song in stereo, demo it to the people who need it. And then when they say, well, this is what I need for the stage, go back into your session and break it out that way, you know, and then remember to keep everything so that it's just in perspective, so that if they just play all of them simultaneously, it just sounds exactly like your mix. And that's kind of the bottom line.
The biggest problem with that is time. So the composers are almost always up against the deadline, and they're constantly getting fixes from directors because they can. They can just keep asking for changes forever, which leaves them little time for, oh, you need it remixed differently? That's going to happen in real time, probably. So it's going to slow down their process. But yeah, I'm talking, of course, mostly about higher end projects for film and TV, which have the budget and the time to do all of this. If you're just entering, you're probably working on very small budgets with maybe a 1 week turnaround. So that, of course, is a whole different ball of wax. You can't, on an episodic television show, you know, mix everything like it's a full orchestra and turn over split stems. Although I did a few episodes of Battlestar Galactica, which used a combination of live instruments and samples. And every week he was delivering at least 96 tracks.
Wow.
Who was the composer?
Bear McCreary.
Wow.
The regular music editor on it was Mike Baber, who's a good friend of mine. And I just filled in for a couple of episodes. But that was, I think, the most complicated I had ever seen on a dub stage. And it's a TV show that had a 1.5 day mix. So you got to do a lot to fill out a 42-minute action show in a day and a half. That's a lot of mixing. And also the producer who came, and I'm not going to say his name, the producer who came micromanaged everything, and that's why they delivered 96 tracks. Because he would say, let's throw out this whole cue and take the strings from the first cue and make that a cue. And of course, the strings alone aren't going to make it. So the music editor basically has to reconstruct a new cue out of bits and pieces from other cues, which in the TV schedule, again, is really crazy to expect that. But on features, that's totally normal.
Yeah, I think that information is really extremely important for people who are moving from, like, you know, maybe having done a few projects into the possibility of meeting with a post supervisor or a music supervisor and, you know, getting heard and getting selected. If you're starting out, and this is just my opinion, you know, simplicity rules.
Yes.
You know, work with the director and try and find out what the emotional arc of the piece is that he's requiring this for. You know, don't just submit a whole bunch of stuff. And then the one thing I tell everybody who works for me is never, ever give a demo to anybody or a recording or a mix to anybody that isn't the absolute best possible representation of who you are. Don't rush. Mm-hmm. Don't, you know, just, you know, try and get it out the door. Don't crush it with compression just to make everything as loud as it can be. The first impression that you make on somebody lasts, believe it or
yes.
not.
Yeah.
A long time. I met Bruce, or the mutual friend we were talking about earlier in the show, who mentored me for 4 years, and I gave him the worst possible mix you could ever imagine handing anybody about anything, but he heard something in what I was trying to do and then ended up teaching me how to actually listen more carefully and mix. But simplicity, just don't worry about all these technical things until you get to the point where somebody's actually demanding that.
Mm-hmm.
Make things sound good and stay simple, and then figure it out as you get further on down the road.
And that thing about demos, I have had – or I've seen artists who, if someone asks them, oh, do you have anything that we could use in this show, they'll turn over their latest rehearsal recording from Zoom H2, or they'll turn over a public performance that was recorded from the back of the room. And again, first impressions can't be changed. If someone hears that, especially someone who's not a musician or a recording engineer, they're just going to think it sounds bad, and they're not going to think about your music. So it does have to be presented very professionally.
This is Steve Cleveland, and you've been listening to Sync Club. Make sure you check out the show notes where you can find additional information regarding our guest, John March, and our guest host, David Bondalevich. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe. Thanks for the hang. We'll see you here next week at the club.